Since 2001, the Cleveland Museum of Natural History has been involved in a variety of cases involving human death under mysterious and suspicious circumstances. We work with the local coroner's office. But one thing we've done recently is attempted to apply this concept of forensic entomology, where we use insects that we can find on a corpse and help provide supporting information for the investigation, and, like I said, apply this information to potential poaching situations. In other words, we can take the insects we find on animals illegally harvested and see if we can't support investigations by wildlife officials. The black bear is a state endangered species in Ohio, and it's also a species on the rise. In other words, the populations are growing due to migration and reproduction and so forth. And you may be familiar, some of you, with a case study that was from British Columbia a few years back, where Gail Anderson had investigated two black bear cubs that were slain and the gallbladders extracted for traditional medicinal remedies. And she was able to use basically the fly maggots present to determine an approximate time of death, and those data were used to then help prosecute two suspects who were eventually jailed for the illegal harvesting of those black bear. So we actually had an opportunity recently when we actually had roadkill nearby the museum a couple counties over, and at that point the carcass was donated to the museum. It was going to be a taxidermy specimen, but it wasn't really going to work out that way, so I said, hey, let me take it, and we'll go ahead and stick this thing out. We'll have some students rummage around and attempt to do essentially a biodiversity inventory of the insects attacking the carcass and helping the decomposition process to see if we could provide some baseline data for potential poaching cases in the future. So here's our guy here. Placed him out. Yeah, poor guy. It's a 138-pound male. So it was probably about a year old when he was hit. And we placed him out in the field for insects to make use of him. So it was in the northeastern part of the county, and we placed it at the edge of a woods in an old field, which would be a typical place where, A, the bears might forage, but B, that may also be where we would have a potential poaching incident. Again, we don't at this point, because of the relatively low numbers of black bear in Ohio, we don't have, as far as I know, a common problem with poaching, but with the increasing numbers, it could very well come to be in the near future. So what we did is we conducted periodic collecting, mostly daily during the first couple of weeks. And this is my student, Laura Bach, and my co-author for this talk. And she did a lot of the collecting. We collected maggots and other arthropods directly off of the carcass. We had wandering maggots, those moving off of the carcass to burrow into the soil. Those were sampled as well. We did sweeps for adults and so forth. We also procured a variety of living specimens, particularly the maggots, for rearings to the adult stage to confirm identifications. We also did a variety of abiotic measurements, such as temperature, humidity, and so forth, for accumulated degree hour calculations. So I'm going to bring you through the first just a couple of weeks of succession, and this talk will basically focus mainly on the blowflies, because obviously they're going to be the most important. Here at day three, we have the bear becoming kind of more relaxed in its pose, so the maggots seem to be helping out with breaking the body down quite rapidly. By day five, the stench is horrendous, the plants are dying around the carcass. We're beginning to see around the anus and genitalia that we have a small maggot mass beginning to build up. By day eight, the maggot mass is becoming quite large. We're beginning to see an increase in temperature around the maggots themselves. We're experiencing temperatures around collection, the ambient temperatures of about 22 degrees centigrade, but within the maggot mass, we're approaching 40 to 42 degrees centigrade. By day 10, the maggot mass was huge, just tens or hundreds of thousands of individuals of blowfly maggots infesting the body. There were also a variety of other taxa present, beetles and so forth. By day 11, this is when we began to see the first movement of the post-feeding larva off of the carcass to form the puparium down inside the soil. So in the early morning, we went out to check on the carcass. We see this the kind of little pathway that we made as we moved back and forth towards the carcass, and the maggots were moving into the surrounding vegetation. So this was wave one. By day 12, we had the second wave, and this was the most tremendous thing I've ever seen. This was a mass exodus off of the carcass. You can see its head in the lower right-hand corner, and on the body there are still tens of thousands of maggots. It had rained the night before, and this stinking froth was just being churned up by the maggot activity. So they're extremely active, and they're moving off in mass into the vegetation again to form the puparium. And on day 14, a couple of days later, we had the third and final wave, but as you can see, you have to look really close to find the maggots. They were moving in mass in an organized fashion, but they were not moving in the numbers that we'd seen previously. And by day 15, maggots were relatively uncommon. There's still a variety of other insects present. When I say maggots, I really mean blowfly maggots, because we had others present on the body. We could occasionally find pyophilids, sepsids, spherocerids, and others. And there are a variety of beetles that are underneath the fur and in the remaining dry tissue that's there. And quite honestly, that's where my photo stopped, because this doesn't really change all that much. If you go out and look at the carcass today, this is pretty much what it looks like, except it's covered with snow. Again, this is northeast Ohio. So let's talk about these waves. These were interesting indicators that may help us in the future. That first day, we had the green bottle fly, Lucilia lustris, and it represented the majority of the maggots, about 60%. But there's also the black blowfly, Formia regina, which represented the remaining 40%. The second wave on day 12, the black blowfly made up nearly 100% of the maggots present. It was certainly the dominant creature that was present on the carcass. And by that third wave on day 14, obviously 2 weeks into decomposition, the black blowfly again had that third wave, and it was the dominant blowfly that was there. Here's just some photos of those, the adults of those two species, with the black blowfly, the most dominant one on the left, and the green bottlefly, which was the initial colonizer of the carcass. And that's actually something that we see with human corpses and other animal carcasses as well, that the green bottleflies tend to move in very rapidly, deposit eggs, and are only present during the initial stages of decomposition, with the black blowfly being more persistent over time. We look at our accumulated degree hours. We plotted that over time during the first 15 days, and we plotted the three waves. As you can see there in the upper right of the graph here. This wasn't really too satisfactory, because this is just based on ambient temperatures taken right near that cage. So we actually redid this such that we began to take into account the increased temperature of the maggot mass and what that created. And indeed, based upon these calculations, we see that the accumulated degree hours more closely match what we find in the literature in terms of the accumulated degree hours needed for development to the post-feeding stage. Without that maggot mass temperature, we were actually seeing values that were accumulated degree hour values that were just much too low. And I think this begins to illustrate, one, the need for having baseline data like this on a regional level, because our data for Northeast Ohio doesn't necessarily match the literature that we find produced by Anderson and Greenberg, and there are other researchers that have said the same thing. So finding that very regional data for your blowflies is going to be extremely important, both for human cases and obviously in potential applications beyond humans. If we look at days post-exposure, this simply illustrates again that idea that Lucilia lustris, the green bottlefly, was the first species that was there. We have the larvae and adults plotted over time on the top there, days 1 through 40, and it certainly laid eggs very quickly, followed by Formia regina. But again, Formia regina was a little more persistent. We could occasionally find maggots present on the very dried carcass. They were able to seemingly do okay, but most of the activity was obviously early on. Just to look at some of the biodiversity that was on the carcasses, just a few of the other species that we found. We have some in the upper left, pyophilid, the genus Steribia. In the upper right, spherocerid, the genus Caproica. And in the lower right, Procoliza, which is another pyophilid, and then a clarid beetle in the lower left. If we just look at our species accumulation curve over time here, what I just want you to notice is by about day 14, day 15, that's when we had the waves of maggots having moved off of the carcass, and then we begin to see really a more strong accumulation of other taxa, such as some of the decomposing beetles, the more predaceous staphylinids, and a variety of others as well. So there was that jump in diversity shortly after the maggots left, and that's probably because they were just so incredibly dominant on the carcass. So to conclude, I'd just like to say that, again, you know, these kinds of data are important to have regionally, and they will allow us to actually, I hope, in the future, if it does become pertinent, that we can help in wildlife poaching cases by creatively applying some standard techniques in entomology two cases like that. And just for some shameless self-promotion, I've got a blog at the museum's website that shows the decomposition projects we had this past summer. So thank you. So you're in the right. The question was how long between the bear was killed and by the time it was deposited out of the site. It was actually placed in a freezer, so it was frozen shortly after being struck by the car, maybe 12 hours, and there was no signs of insect activity on it when we inspected it. So we placed it out there after thawing, which is never an optimal situation, but we're taking advantage of a positive aspect of roadkill in a way. So thank you.